beautiful sphere, but nevertheless its lunar life was passionless, uncheckered by sorrow, undimmed by crime, untouched by the witch wand of time. 'Twas all too grand, there was no scope for dread, and of course no room for hope. For who the future had no fear to make the present doubly dear, the day no cast of coming night to make the borrowed ray more bright, and life itself no thought of death to sanctify the boon of breath. In short, as we world people say, the woman in the moon was ennuye. Anyway.
That was wonderful, terrific.
Yes, I thought it was actually. Now, one of the aspects I wanted to actually look at was the fact that in many early civilizations, time was actually measured by the moon. We had lunar cycles, which of course are very much in harmony with women's menstrual cycle and with the reproductive cycles of nature's creatures. And with an increasingly patriarchal society, we have become further removed from those dimensions of being, and the many cultures that represent those ways of being are being destroyed, including the Aboriginal culture in our own country. And in relation to the space station at Cape York, I'm very concerned about the effect on Aboriginal culture, and that's even more Aboriginal land that's being taken for a white technological society. Also in matriarchal civilizations, where time was very much lunar, there were moon priestesses, and women held far more respect, commanded far more authority than in patriarchal societies. I'm going to read some things or talk about some things I've got from a book called Moon Moon by Anne Kent Rush, who is an American feminist. And she actually went and spoke to some of the astronauts who had been to the moon, and got a couple of them to talk about, including Jim Irwin especially, their spiritual experiences or their spiritual responses to having been to the moon.
That was certainly very clear from there. You probably saw the thing in the Australian magazine, I think it was last week, to coincide the anniversary of the moon landing, and just what a almost devastating effect it had on the lives of the men who actually, I think there were 12 of them, who've actually been up to the moon, or at least out in space. And it was interesting to read that it had that effect on them, something that they've actually over 20 years never really recovered from.
Well, she actually sees that, in a sense, she sees that there's a positive dimension in that, to that, because she sees men's need to technologically travel to the moon as being the way that they can, through their intellect, which is the way that the patriarchal mind functions, primarily through the intellect, and there's very much a fear of other ways of knowing, of more intuitive and mystical ways of knowing. And I'm not saying, I think the intellect is included in that as well. I don't believe in separating the intellect from intuition. I think that they're actually blended.
But, well,
I think
also feeling can be intelligent.
That's what I mean. What I mean is that the patriarchal mind is fearful of intellect that includes feeling. And that because so many men have become alienated from that way of being, that in fact, you know, they travel to the moon through all this technology, when in fact in matriarchal civilizations the moon was seen in a far more spiritual context. And apparently at the time of the moon landings, the Balinese government wanted to protest. I mean, I don't know whether it did actually happen, but according to Balinese culture, it's absolutely taboo for humans to invade the moon, because there's a very deep respect for the moon in Balinese culture, and they considered it a violation of the moon for men or humans to land on it. And also in my readings of mythology from Anne Kent's book, that in many cultures the moon is actually seen as the land where the souls of the dead and the unborn reside, because that's both the same dimensions, that before we're born and when we die, we are in similar realms. And Aboriginal culture believes that too, not so much about the moon, but that the realm of the unborn and the realm of the dead is similar. And I also want to look at, in patriarchal society, we have the concept of lunacy and lunatics. And Anne Kent talks about the fact that because in matriarchal civilizations, a lot of the rituals that surrounded the moon were actually sexual and orgiastic, and the patriarchal society is also very fearful of those ways of being, that when we move into states that are very much away from the rational intellectual mind, that is seen as madness in a patriarchal society, because the whole sort of productive work ethic oriented way of being relies on a fairly severe repression of more cyclical modes, which is what lunar time is about. Right. It's about that you don't have constant productivity 12 months of the year, that humans, like nature, need to rest, like we have winter to rest and go inwards. Nature is resting during winter. But the patriarchal way of being is that we must constantly force the earth, we must constantly force people to produce 12 months of the year without listening to our own rhythms, that we deny our own rhythms. And I consider that that actually contributes to the destructive madness of patriarchy, the fact that we do not allow neither the earth nor the human psyche to have a more cyclical way of being, and we also are denying our sexual cycles. And women are made, you know, despite the fact that we have menstrual cycles, we're made to sort of deny that if we're going to fit into the kind of work ethic reality. And I actually see it as positive that, you know, women often want to take time off.
I was sort of interested to hear what you were saying about patriarchal society and the enthusiasm with which it pursues technological things. But do you think there's a way in which they're using that technology, perhaps even for a spiritual journey, which in fact what the moon landing was all about ultimately, I think? It was using it to get there in that sort of way. And undergo that experience.
Oh, yes, I agree. I agree with that. And I think that that's why these astronauts have been so affected in that way. But I'm saying that the fact that they had to do it through technology, which is having, I think, we cannot deny that technology is having a very devastating environmental effect on the Earth. Apart from all the effluent, indigenous cultures are being destroyed so that more technology can be produced, so that their land can be mined, so that the forests can be felled and all those sorts of things. So, yes, I see that it was a symbolic spiritual journey by men, but what I'm saying is that in matriarchal civilizations, perhaps people were able to reach that dimension of moon consciousness in other ways that were not so abstract, in a sense, and that did not have the environmental, destructive environmental impacts that technology has.
Do you think they're mutually exclusive then, technology and that sort of spiritual side of life?
Well, a technology that relies on so much destruction of nature to perpetuate itself, I see, must be. You know, I'm not saying that, I mean, I think that people have tried to do positive things with technology, but I don't see how it can be. If we have to keep destroying the earth, the environment, to create this technology, then yes, I see that they are mutually exclusive. I think that we need to find ways of creating things that don't have to deplete the earth more and more.
Look, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks very much, Lorne, for coming in. And behind us you can hear a track that she's brought in called Lunar Muse. Whereabouts did that come from?
It's from an album called Moon Circles, and that's by an American flautist called Kay Gardner, and she has a whole lot of tracks about the moon and the woman in the moon, that sort of thing, on the album.
Thanks very much. You're listening to Hardly News, and the time is 1 minute past 10. Thank you. A Harsh Mistress. Great song, bringing the time on Hardly News up to 5 minutes past 10. And we want to thank all those people who rang in last week with their donations to our annual radiothon. Look, thanks very much. We achieved our target. In fact, I think we went over our target, which is fantastic. So if you haven't sent them in already, just a reminder to send the money into Postbox 1277 Collingwood 3066, or you can call in here at the station at 21 Smith Street, Collingwood, and we'll be happy to greet you at the door and take your money. And thanks very much. And I think now we should go on with a bit more with Hardly News. Well, I was talking earlier to Andrew Rennie about some, and also Mark Blair, about some of the problems associated with the Cape York spaceport, and we were talking a little about some of the problems with aircraft exploding, or perhaps debris coming down and damaging the environment on Earth. But of course we also have to think about the environment up in space. I understand it's actually clogging up a bit these days, Andrew. Is that right? There seems to be quite a bit of equipment up there already.
Yes, well, there's 7,200 objects being tracked right now in space. That doesn't mean to say there's only 7,200 objects up there. The North American Air Defence Command can track objects down as small as about 10 centimetres across. That's about the size of a tennis ball. And anything smaller than that can't be tracked, at least not normally. So we know that there's 7,200 trackable objects up there right now. We expect that there's about 20,000 other bits and pieces, as small as tiny flecks of paint, for example. Now, even a fleck of paint can be dangerous to another spacecraft because it is travelling at about 8 kilometres a second in orbit around the Earth, and a collision with even a paint fragment at that sort of speed can do an enormous amount of damage to a spacecraft, which, after all, are very lightly built. They're not built for the stresses of flying through the air, so that they can be built very lightly.
Well, I mean, that the spaceport was imagining in the Cape York one that they'd be sending up, what, about 5 or 6 launches a year. How many craft would be launched into space annually? Any idea?
Well, over the last few years, the average has been around about between 130 and 110 objects. For example, last year, there were 116 launches into space. In 1987, there were 110, in 86, 103, and a peak year, I think, was 1984, when there were 129 launches into space.
Well, how many of those objects would ever come down to Earth again?
Oh, the vast majority of them. So far, they've tracked in space over 20,000 objects, and of those, 7,200 are still up there.
So, in fact, if it's actually so dangerous to have all this debris flying around up there at this tremendous rate, there must come a point at which it's actually going to be worthwhile for space agencies, surely, to retrieve some of it, or at least try and collect it together.
Yes, that's right. They're doing a certain amount already. There are several critical orbits. One is very low Earth orbit. And the debris there doesn't tend to last up there very long, several weeks to several years at most. For example, Solar Max, which NASA went up and repaired at one time with the space shuttle, it's coming down early next year due to atmospheric drag. So certain things come down after a certain time. Another but very critical
Do we have any
orbit,
control over where they come down or not?
No. No, generally speaking, no. Although, with very large objects, for example, the Soviets with their Salyut space stations, they have deliberately deorbited those over the Pacific Ocean. Again, with their Progress supply
ships. Relief.
Yes, with their Progress supply ships, for example, that go up to the Mir space station, they're packed up away with debris and stuff, and instead of throwing the trash overboard, they simply collect the rubbish together and deorbit it inside the spacecraft, and it burns up in the atmosphere over the Pacific Ocean. So nothing actually reaches the Earth again.
So do the other space agencies, like the US or European Space Agency, ever attempt to do anything like that? I mean, they must have quite big, valuable pieces of equipment circulating around up there.
Yes, well, the other thing that is being done in that sort of nature is the geostationary orbit is getting rather cluttered. And what they're doing now, they didn't do this in the first few years, but nowadays they... a spacecraft nearing the end of its life uses the last bit of its station-keeping fuel to actually boost it into a higher orbit, which means it'll stay up there for several million years out of the way of the new satellites going into this very critical orbit.
They've pushed it out. It's a bit like the suburbs, isn't it? Sort of when
yes.
It starts getting squashed in the inner city, it's sort of spread further out. It's not as though it goes away.
Yes.
Well, I don't know what I think about that. I tend to be a bit disapproving.
Well, the thing is, we just don't have the financial resources and the technical ability to actually go up there and collect up every tiny piece of rubbish that's orbiting around the Earth. Remember, it goes around the Earth every 90 minutes. There's 7,200 trackable objects there. There's many more untrackable. And at the moment, it's just not feasible to go up there and fetch it back. In the future, it will be. And in the future, this will, in fact, have to be done. But at the moment, it's just not economically possible, and it's not technologically feasible to actually do it.
I can see the day when there's going to have to be an environmental statement made about the sort of outer atmosphere of the Earth. I think it's getting a bit much out there. Is there an actual danger to us with all this stuff cluttering up? I mean, direct danger to all these objects in geostationary orbit?
Well, no, on geostationary orbit, no, absolutely none at all. It's the heavy material in low Earth orbit. Occasionally you get a piece of debris arise back on Earth. And one, for example, landed in a street in Wisconsin once, in the middle of a street. But the danger from falling space debris is, in fact, far less than the danger from meteorites. Your dangers of getting hit by meteorites is far, far greater than the danger of being hit by man-made space debris. And, of course, the danger of being hit by lightning is far greater again, even than that.
Well, what about the danger of the objects out in space? You were saying that even a paint of flake travels at,
eight kilometres a second.
A second, that's right. And are there incidents where equipment's actually been damaged? Say OSSAT has a satellite up there. What are the chances of our satellite being damaged by debris like that?
Well, studies have been made on that, and the answers depend on who you talk to, but it's been estimated that OSSAT might be hit once every 20 years by a piece of debris and disabled. Several satellites have been disabled. Last year, a Soviet satellite was struck by debris and exploded into a huge number of fragments.
So then you have all these fragments and they have to send up another satellite, I guess, don't they, because the other one's out of order.
Most satellites these days are being designed to last about 10 years. After that, they become derelicts.
Oh, grim. Look, I think we'll have to leave it there. Thanks very much for speaking to us, Andrew Rennie. And you're listening to Harley News, and the time is getting on for, what, 12 minutes past 10 o'clock.
Gem there. That's a record that I've long been wanting to play. In fact, we found this in a record shop, Island Songs of the Great Barrier Reef, last year, and we were saving this for something to do with the Fitzgerald Inquiry. However, that happened when we weren't having hardly news. We were having babies and exams and things like that. So it was I was thrilled when I realised there was a song on there, Moonlight on Magnetic, and that's Rod Rogers with the Tropic Island Serenaders, and I think we'll be saving this up for a Queensland show. In fact, we'll probably have to construct a Queensland show around the record. It's rather lovely, isn't it?
It's wonderful. It's like one of the Shirley Toms, a great favourite.
Well, Queensland certainly has a lot to offer culturally, there's no question about it. And these particular songs, I mean, that's one of the images that the moon has for most of us, isn't it? The association with love and perfect situations, like being on a tropical island and perfectly happy.
Well, let's cross to another favourite.
Stardate 2434.2. First Officer's Log. On a routine patrol flight in the Milky Way galaxy, I discovered on our space sensors an unidentified planet careening wildly in an eccentric solar orbit. I ordered an immediate investigation and, with much difficulty, maneuvered our ship for a temporary orbit. Planet's surface, all I could see were ruins. Ruins of some type of civilization. Crumbled buildings, deserted streets, charred vegetation, all covered with a thick layer of dust, which our scanners indicated as intensely radioactive. I proceeded to make a thorough survey of the area. According to my calculations, I could tell that some recent phenomenon or holocaust had occurred and destroyed whatever advanced civilization had existed on the planet. I found no sign of life. As I made my way back to the ship, I heard a sound. It came from a cellar in one of the nearby buildings. Carefully and slowly, I found my way to the source and discovered a human being, or rather, what once was a human being, a scarred, disfigured man lying in the rubble. When I questioned him, he told me that this had once been a great world. They had abundance and plenty, intelligence, beauty, love. There was enough for everyone who lived there. But the inhabitants were never satisfied. They wanted more. They wanted everything. And they started to quarrel amongst themselves. They could not live in peace. And they tried to destroy each other. In doing this, they destroyed everything. Their abundance, their plenty, their own intelligence, their beauty, their love. He told me that so far as he knew, he was the only living thing left, but that he knew he was dying. When I asked him the name of the planet, he replied, "We called it Earth."
Well, that was very moving, Margot. Mr. Spock, all the way from the Starship Enterprise.
Yes, I'm glad you trotted that, yet another of our old favourites out. I'm still looking at my newspaper here, which I didn't get a chance to talk about before, but also inspired by the notion of space junk out there. You know, I think from the way I've been reading this article, I think they left a TV on the moon.
Oh, I wonder what they're watching up
well,
there.
Well, you make what you can of it. It says... Two television cameras went to the moon with Apollo 11, but only one will return to Earth. A 13-pound coloured television camera was installed in the command module to record its trip to, during and from lunar orbit, and a 7.25-pound black and white camera has been installed on board the module to record the lunar landing. The black and white camera will be placed on the moon to record the astronauts' movements. It should operate for approximate 2 hours and 40 minutes when the astronauts are on the moon. It will lose power after the Eagle module lifts off and returns to dock with command.
So its little screen's gone grey, is that right?
Yeah. So yeah. I reckon there's a little telly up there. Yeah. It's really interesting, this is the 20 years ago paper celebrating the trip to the moon. But the way television came into the fore during that is pretty remarkable. Most of the newspapers of the time, most people who have memories say, oh yes, school stopped and we watched TV. It's in this article, it has nearly all, I think it was Channel 9 that devoted the whole of their coverage over the days to simply recording all the GTV 9 has been staying on view 24 hours a day since Saturday for those who can prop their eyes open all night. So apart from anything else, the Apollo mission, when completed, will have given us 1 week of non-stop TV. This probably has shift workers jumping for joy. They, of all people, may not even have seen some of the feature films which are being screened. Yeah, but it also says it's easy to expect television to entertain us and to make leisure time disappear, but when it can serve us, as with the Apollo mission, it deserves new respect.
Although watching it on television did a strange thing to me, because I was
so... Made it unreal.
Well, it did, and I kept thinking, oh, look, I'm sitting in friend's lounge room, having come home early from school, and thinking, oh, this is a hoax, they're not really doing it. How can it be on television, men dressed up in those clothes?
Yes, I refuse. It was hard to take it seriously. I agree with you there.
In fact, it frightened me a little because I thought there might be some poor man circulating out in an orbit, unable ever to get back. I was rather confused about the...
It's funny
business
that
about orbiting while others were on the moon.
A lot of people do sort of refer to what they were doing the day that Armstrong landed on the moon. I honestly can't remember, but Marjorie Bly can, and I think I might have mentioned to you that I do have her new book, Life is for Living. It's autobiographical. It's the heartaches and happiness of Marjorie Bly. And I'll just read you...
Is that the title?
I'll read you the paragraph that she... Marjorie, incidentally, is very a thrifty person and very creative in recycling materials. I'll just read you her entry for that time. I'd been given some old jumpers at Redpa, and from them, and some of ours, I cut out 81 squares and made a warm rug during winter. By July, I had sold all the first edition of At Home with Marjorie Blackwell, that was her maiden name, or no, her former name, married three times, and regretted that I had only had 1,000 printed. I still get requests for that book too, and the second edition. Adrian cemented in a lamppost. Also in July, and on the 17th, the council workmen were preparing our nature strip for cement curbing, so they said we could have all the surplus soil. By the end of the day, I'd wheeled in 39 barrow loads, and more next day. So much to do and so little to do it. At 6:18 a.m. on the 21st of July 1969, Apollo 11 with Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins and Edwin Aldrin landed on the moon, with Neil taking the first step at 12:55 p.m., followed by Buzz Aldrin 20 minutes later. Then at 9:30, we watched him on television place a disc on the moon, which had the inscription around the rim, "From Planet Earth, July 1969. At the time, we were at the home of Mr. and Mrs. Stan Harvey in Launceston, as they were giving Jan a party for her 21st birthday, helped by Jan's sister and brother-in-law Kay and Max Edwards of Sisters Creek. Early August 1969, I received a letter to say I had to appear on Mike Preston's IMT wheel in Melbourne on the 11th, so Adrian decided to accompany me. A taxi met us at the airport and drove us to the Hotel London, where there was a smorgasbord dinner waiting. It was the first I had ever seen. Endless tables of food, even a pig's head dressed up for the occasion. Adrian took my photo with the head and a chef posing alongside, but because I felt sick, I couldn't eat a thing. I was mad with myself, as there were numerous cheesecakes and meringues around. I didn't know then that I had gallstones, and that was why I was feeling off colour. We were dressed and ready when the taxi arrived at 6:15 to take us to the show. When it was my turn to appear on the stage to spin the wheel, I became shy, so Adrian filled in for me. He spun the wheel, answered the question, and won a deluxe gas glow fire. We stayed the night at the hotel and came home the next day.
This woman leads another life as Barry Humphrey's scriptwriter, I think.
Oh, certainly Barry Humphreys has requested from her a volume, and in fact she documents that. But laugh as you may, I happen to use Marjorie Bly's 1,000 Hints, the volume that she talks about, that so many people request, and it's called At Home with Marjorie Blackwell, one of the first editions. And interestingly enough, it's the book that I'm always turning to when I'm in the kitchen.
Well, it's not her handy hint with what to do with 1,000 pantyhose legs, is it?
No, no, that's a separate book.
Right.
Yes.
Well, you were listening there to Lassie Goes to the Moon.
And it's time for us to go. I'd like to thank all the people who helped us this morning. Special thanks to Raina and Fritz and Alex and Julie. And our guests for coming into the studio. We always appreciate that enormously.
And we'll be back next week to talk about health and some of the issues around there, particularly looking at, I think, focusing in on the public versus private health issues. It's time for us to go. See you next week.